work-life balance is a myth. I think you can have it all. I don't think you can have it all at once. You can look at my resume and see where I was getting majorly lapped by all of my peers. It slowed down while I was off having kids, and that was difficult to handle, but I was appreciative of the value and the parenting that I didn't have to compromise because I was there for every single thing with my kids. I didn't miss one milestone, and I'm proud of that. What I did do during that time was a skill build. Let me do the work. Let me demonstrate and work towards my readiness. And then I accelerated pretty fast later on. Ultimately, in the long view, it all balanced out.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Ruman Segal, recovering marketer.
And I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer. Ruman and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know, but want to know more about.
It's kind of like being a fly on the wall for my mentoring coffees.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Tiana Conley, Vice President of Global Cereal for the Kellogg Company. It's a really good conversation about both work and life and pretty much everything in between. Here's a little bio on Tiana. Tiana Conley serves as the Vice President of Global Cereal for the Kellogg Company, where she is responsible for the $6 billion flagship portfolio with treasured brands such as Special K, Frosted Flakes, Fruit Loops, and Corn Flakes. Prior to joining Kellogg, she was Marketing Director of Global Tequila at Beam Suntory and held a variety of marketing roles at Kimberly-Clark and started her career at Procter & Gamble. She received a Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering from University of Illinois and her MBA from Xavier University. Tiana is based in Chicago and is the mother of two children, Griffin and Ava. And what I really love about this conversation is both Tiana's perspective on both work and life. Not necessarily work-life balance, something that she calls a myth, but both the kind of the mix of the two things. She started first with sharing a little bit more about how she's made career decisions and how she knew to pivot from, say, one function, engineering, into marketing as well and what that was like. She also geeked out about triangle tests for a moment. But she also has a great perspective on making the right personal decisions in the context of a career. And that's what I really appreciate about her insights, as well as thinking about diversity and inclusion, not just as a like, let's have a conversation about it, but doing a little bit more. I also laughed out loud multiple times from what she says. She's a very funny human being. So let's dive right in. We hope you'll enjoy our conversation with Tiana. Tiana, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very excited to be chatting with you. People, they may know your professional story. You graduated from the University of Illinois with a degree in chemical engineering and started at Procter & Gamble as a senior engineer. Along the way, you got your MBA from Xavier University and rising to senior brand manager of North America Olay. From there, you moved to senior brand manager roles at Kimberly-Clark and then marketing director at Beam Suntory. And then now you're the VP of Global Cereal at Kellogg. But my first question for you is that the career you imagined growing up? What did young little Tiana want to grow up to become?
I mean, heck no. I definitely did not envision that for myself. I'm not even sure that I had a concept of what corporate America was as a child. I come from a middle-class family. My mom worked as a payroll manager. My dad worked in IT. And I really didn't have a clear vision of what I wanted to be when I grew up. I always liked math and science, but I bounced around in terms of when I was very little, what I wanted to be, anything from a doctor to Miss America to an ice skater. Never mind that I never took ice skating lessons, but I did love watching figure skating with my mom as a kid.
Oh, I love, man, I'm watching this. I've never done it, but maybe that's a career for me. Love that perspective. And so as a child, were there any formative experiences or things that happened either growing up with family or in school or things that shaped some of either what you decided to study or what you do now?
There were a couple of things. I think the first thing was having really supportive parents that didn't box me into having any form of stereotypes around what I could or couldn't do. I think my parents just encouraged me to be my best and to pursue whatever interest I had. So I did grow up in at least a pre-STEM awareness era. And so I think that I don't necessarily feel my parents said, oh, well, if you're interested in science, that's not a girl thing. My parents were, wherever your heart and interests carry you, go with that. And I think that was really helpful because it encouraged me to explore wherever my natural interests lied. And then I think the thing that really cemented me pursuing engineering was in my formative years in high school as a person. So my background is that I'm half Black and I'm half Filipino. My mom's an immigrant from the Philippines. And growing up, I didn't have teachers that looked me. You know, I didn't see myself reflected in my educators, but I did have one Black chemistry teacher in high school. His name was Mr. Gustav, and he really challenged me and encouraged me in high school. And he said, you're really good at chemistry and you're really good at math. And I think that chemical engineering would be a great degree for you to pursue. And so I looked into that, and then I trust him. He's really smart. Actually, he's so smart, I'm not sure why he teaches here. I'm sure that's he could probably have his own podcast about that. But that seems good. And I checked the box and I went with that degree.
Wow. So I have a couple of wonderful things about that, especially because some of our listeners are here specifically for the career advice. And some people are here for the managing life things and stuff. And so one great insight from what your parents did of being that supportive and, you said, not putting you into that box, but also then with your teacher, how important mentorship and in some ways representation then is, right? This was one of the few people that you could say, oh, here's someone that maybe understands me in this way. And the fact that there is that mentorship angle seems it may have been had perhaps even more of an impact because it was, okay, this is possible. And so you go that route, right? You go to the University of Illinois and get a degree in engineering. And then after you graduated and started working at Procter & Gamble right away, was that what you imagined post-university life would be, that first role, or was it something completely different?
Well, I did have a little bit of a perspective at that point because I had the opportunity and the blessing to do internships. So I did three. They were really diverse. I did one internship at Abbott Laboratories outside of Chicago. So working in the pharmaceutical industry, it wasn't chemical engineering, it was more mechanical engineering, but I worked on the line installation for what at the time was a big blockbuster drug launch for Prevacid. And essentially wrote safety manuals for part of the line installation. It sounds super geeky, but it was interesting to me. I liked it. It was a good company. And the second internship I had was at General Mills. And I worked on a formula cost savings for Betty Crocker frosting. And I got to do a lot of triangle tests that summer, trying to see, can you taste the cost savings and the ingredient reduction? And I ate so much cake that summer, but I did a lot of exercise, so it offset. But I thought that was super cool as well. And then when I worked at P&G, I really enjoyed that the most because of the consumer-centric nature of the work at Procter & Gamble. And so it was really not just straight up engineering or research and development where I was. It was very insights-driven work. And I really, really resonated with that. And that's what really made me come to the company. And so by the time that they did make me an offer at the end of the summer, which was a wonderful thing for them to do because it made my senior year great. I actually had awesome grades because I put my mind at ease and I could really perform at school. But I did have a good idea of what I was coming to by the time I got there, because I had had the flavor from my internship, and that was a good thing.
Yeah, well, and I think that something called a triangle test, I think, is a triangle test plus eating a bunch of cake. I'm sold. Can I do that now? That's amazing. Right. That's a fantastic internship to have. But having those experiences gives you more of that decision. I agree. I also had an offer from PNG based off of an internship, and it does make senior year a little bit easier when one of your focuses isn't job search and what am I going to do afterwards or whatever, knowing that this thing, assuming that I continue to do well that and actually graduate on time and all of that, that it does make it a little bit easier. And I think that it's a valuable thing for leaders of organizations to recognize. I think PNG has a good feed into that pipeline because of heavy recruiting on campuses and then saying, hey, this is an opportunity for people to learn and grow and see what it's going to be. So you spend 2 years in engineering and then you make the switch to marketing. So what drove that decision to say, hey, rather than going the R&D route or engineering route, I'm going to go into brand management?
Well, I think that the highly integrated cross-functional nature of the work at Procter & Gamble really gave me the opportunity to interface more with the marketing function, as I mentioned. So I was actually doing the products research function within research and development, which for those not as familiar with it, is really what I like to call a cross between consumer research and research and development. And that the work that I was doing was specifically around claims development. So it's, hey, we have this great technology. How do we express that in a way that's meaningful to consumers? So when you're watching TV and it's this sock's wider than the other sock, yeah, I was that person. Both how do you make the demo and then how do you prove it and then all of that stuff. And part of one of the things I got to do was go on shoots and do the claim support for the advertising. And so I had a chance to get an insight into some of the duties of marketers. And I'm like, I think I want to do that. And having come to the company when I was just 21 years old, one of the great things about PNG is that because they are promote from within, essentially their entire corporate pipeline comes from building the bottom up. And so I think they're quite invested in making sure that they give great development pathways to their employees. And so when I went to my boss, they're like, sure, well, let's give you that opportunity. And they originally brought it to me as a broadening assignment in the sense that if you're not successful in marketing, you can come back and we'll just call that a failed experiment, right? We'll call it broadening. You got a glimpse and you got to come back. So if it doesn't work out, you still have a job. And I did appreciate that safety net.
Well, and I think that it provides a great level of comfort with that idea of a broadening assignment. Because we talked to a pretty senior person in supply chain that said that they did a similar quote-unquote broadening assignment into a different function, and it ended up not working out. And they actually went back into product supply and had a great career there. So it was nice that it wasn't like, this is the end of the world. You make this decision, neither works or doesn't. You have that. And so, you know, I think some of the people listening, they may be interested in that pivot of a career and switching into a different function. Any words of wisdom or insight that you gained from your experience, say, that helped you to do it? Was it one, just speaking up and saying, hey, this is something that I want to try, or how you applied? Any thoughts on for people who might be thinking about that for themselves?
Yeah, I think I'm a very bold person by nature. So I feel a bit that perhaps what I didn't know didn't hurt me. Perhaps I was too ignorant to know that maybe there was a downside to asking or see the risk. So perhaps if you're thinking about making a move or making the change, you can't get what you don't ask for.
That's actually great clarification, right? Because your managers would never know something that. And I think a lot of times people are, why don't people in my organization do blank? And it's, have you asked for it? Do they even know that that's a thing that you like? But so it clearly worked out for you, right? So you stay in brand management, you go from ABM to then brand manager, and then you make the switch to brand management still with Kimberly Clark, going to marketing director and now VP at Kellogg. And so I'm curious, how have you made these career decisions? How have you known when it's been time to look for new opportunities? Is it something that you go outwardly and seek? Is it something a recruiter comes to you and it just seems to be a good fit? How have you made those decisions from P&G, Kimberly-Clark, Beam to Kellogg?
I got a great piece of advice from a leader actually at P&G once that was my boss. And I remember having this very strong sense of loyalty to P&G. And I think part of that comes with it being your first employer. And again, I was 21 when I started. So in a way, P&G raised me. And I remember when headhunters would call, I'd be like, don't call me. And my boss at the time was like, you should always take headhunter calls and at least see what they're talking about. And I thought that was a great piece of advice. And the way that I've internalized that moving forward is I always take headhunter calls. And the reason why is I think there's two things. Well, there are a number of things that can help you do. Number one, even if you love where you're at and you take a headhunter call, when you see another opportunity, it helps reaffirm your commitment to where you are and remind you why you love it. So it's just very affirming to always choose to stay where you are. Mm-hmm. I think that's number one. But number two, sometimes there's just something better. And that's just the truth. And number three is sometimes you want to stay where you are, but having another option on the table can help you negotiate to a better position. So you may be where you are, but you feel maybe you are not quite at the pay benchmark you should be at, or maybe you'd like to accelerate your advancement timetable, or maybe you're behind in your advancement. You can use those opportunities to negotiate yourself to a better position in a company that you love.
I love all three points because I think you're right, especially any organization that you join first out of university, I think you're probably going to have a strong affinity for, at least P&G certainly do. And I had that same mindset of what would I possibly leave? And I'd love to start my own thing. So it felt a little bit different in some ways. But I love that point that you said of just knowing what's out there and then deciding to stay reaffirms that decision. It almost makes you more, oh, this hasn't been a passive thing that I've decided, but here's a proactive decision that I've made. So I love that. And even to the point of if you want to stay, it helps you better leverage that position because just from a career perspective, especially for millennials, we've seen that change of, oh, if you want to actually advance and get paid more and stuff like that, you've got to leave other organizations. You're going to make more by leaving and going to another company than just waiting for a promotion in the one that you're in. But that third option you said is almost a balance of both is to say, hey, I'm being here, I could go to this and this is what I would get, but I want to stay here. Can we get a little bit closer? So I love that balance. And for yourself, when you've been weighing those three different options, what's been important for you to say, oh, this is an opportunity that I do want to take? What criteria do you use to judge these options?
Yeah, for me, what's driven my moves has often been of a personal nature, more so than out of sometimes even what I'm looking for from a development standpoint. So for example, I was having a great time at Kimberly-Clark, but then I had a really big personal life change where I was going through a divorce and I was relocating back to my hometown of Chicago. And I just wasn't able to facilitate the move with Kimberly-Clark. So that's what drove me to make that change. So I think life sometimes comes at you and makes changes happen. When I left P&G, I was at this point in my career where I had spent 10 years there and I had this phenomenal run working on the skincare business on Olay, where I had done so many super cool things building this together with this incredible organization and team, the Olay Dynasty, and creating what we call the mastige business. We're capturing all these consumers from the prestige channels and department stores into the food, drug, and mass. And I had done all these cool jobs where I was working P&L and advertising and innovation and shopper roles and global roles, local roles, and did one of the first celebrity campaigns with Angela Bassett, with an African-American, with Angela Bassett. It was super cool. But then I had a chance to go to Kimberly Clark and work on the global bath tissue business. And that company was operated completely differently than P&G. P&G, everything radiates out of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. We make the widget in Cincinnati and then produce that widget the same all around the world. And the business model at Kimberly Clark is exactly not that. The global footprint has been largely created through M&A. And so the portfolio was very much decentralized and fragmented. And so they really wanted to create more of a centralized business model and way of working and a global capability around marketing. And I'm like, that just sounds cool. And mm-hmm. and also I had some of the biggest marketing spend budgets I think I'll ever see in my entire career when I was working beauty and skincare. And there's hardly any spend at all on bath tissue. And listen, if I can be successful selling something there, I know I'm a good marketer because we're not doing any spending. Yeah. And so I really wanted to test myself and my skills. And so that was motivating there. And then seeing, can I do that in a totally different culture?
Yeah, well, and I think that aspect of, okay, a professional challenge early on to set the stage there and doing something different, I love that. Okay, this would mean if I can do this well, it's going to mean that I'm a good marketer. I love that as a challenge, right? Putting out it face on. But then what you said really with the change from Kimberly Clark of life, right? It was very much a life decision. I think we sometimes forget that our careers are supposed to support the life that we want rather than almost the opposite. And so to make those decisions, and that's what I'm curious is, you know, so how, cause you're the mother of two, how have thinking about your kids and other things informed decisions in terms of how you either careers or opportunities that you've chosen, or even how you do your work, this quote unquote famed idea of work-life balance. What is that mean to you with your work and your life?
Yeah, I think it's a driving force for me. So as I alluded to, I'm a divorced mom, a single mom. I mean, share custody, but I'm a single mom when I have my kids, and they're 6 and 7 years old, so they're young. And I've just decided that I want to be a very active and present parent for my children. And that has implications to how I do my work and how much time I can devote to my work. And so that's been a very motivating and driving force in terms of how I approach my work and what I can give and what I can't give, to be very honest about it. And it's just something that I'm really upfront with when I go for something, and I'm just really clear that I am a parent who, at least pre-pandemic, goes to field trips and shows up on reading day and career day, and I'm active and I'm supportive of my kids. And if my employer can't support that, it's probably not the right place for me.
Wow. And so have you, because I think that's a place where a lot of our listeners want to get to, either they've already got kids and thinking about it and they wish they had that better quote unquote balance, or maybe they're thinking about family and thinking, oh, that means it's completely derailing my career or not. And so any tips on that? Has that mindset led to you saying the no to certain opportunities or getting pushback from certain people? Do you think it's stalled things, and how have you, any tips or tricks on how to do it well?
Oh my goodness. I think part of it is that work-life balance is a myth. It's fake. It doesn't exist. I think you can have it all. I don't think you can have it all at once. I think that particularly if you're a mom, if you think that having children is not a career derailer, it is. You can look at my resume and see that there was a really long lag at some levels where I was getting majorly lapped by all of my peers and frankly people that I coached and reported to me passed me too. And it slowed down pretty majorly to a drip there for a while I was off having kids and in the early stages, especially. That was a little difficult egotistically to handle, especially as somebody who takes a lot of pride in their career and also feeling I had the ability to do it. But I think the way that I internalized that was being very appreciative of the value and the parenting that I didn't have to compromise, because I promise you, I was there for every single thing with my kids. I did not miss one tooth coming in. I didn't miss sitting up, walking, crawling. I didn't miss one milestone of anything. I was going through my kids' baby books with them the other day, and it's every first lock of hair, every first tooth that came out, every little thing, it's captured in there, and I'm proud of that. So I wouldn't go back and rewind and trade that, because I think ultimately in the long view, it all balanced out. So I think if you can look at it that way, what I did do while my career wasn't technically progressing in title was I tried to be as aggressive as I could in pay where I could or where it was permissible. And then I tried to skill build during that time. So it's like, hey, I don't have the title, but let me get the skills. Let me do the work. Let me show that I'm capable of it. And let me demonstrate what I can do. Let me show that I'm capable. And whether I get the official stripe or not, let me demonstrate and work towards my readiness. And then I accelerated pretty fast later on.
Yeah, well, and I imagine one that your kids very much appreciate that you were there for all of those things, because there are certainly plenty of leaders that, A, got to this rank, but it's, oh, that my family barely knows who I am, or they weren't there for those moments. So what a great metric of success for you to be, no, I was here for my family. And also you said that you own the, okay, if it's not happening externally, what can I do internally in my control to maybe be ready to set the stage? And which I think is wonderful. But as a senior leader now, as someone in this position to advising people or as a mentor or as direct reports and things like that, any thoughts on what we either as leaders or as organizations to do so it's not the case that it's not, well, you get to decide. You either get to be there for your children's sports events and things like that, or you get to be a senior leader. Anything that we should start to be doing differently to better support that?
There's people on my team now that have, I'm thinking of someone that just came back from maternity leave that I think kicks ass as a top performer. And I don't think that young kids prevents her from doing so. And so I think if you can be objective and step back and say, did the person deliver? Yeah. They turned it out, you know what I mean? And so I think that COVID, for example, the fact that everyone's working from home has been an equalizer in that sense, where if you take away the schmoozing at the water cooler, you take a step back and you're like, well, what did people actually produce in terms of output? And you just look at it objectively, versus all that sometimes the extra stuff that that people count as output that really isn't. That's one way to look at it. I would say as somebody that falls into categories that are often marginalized on multiple vectors, you have some intersectionalities going on. I'm a woman, I'm Black, I'm Asian, you know, my mom is an immigrant. I have many people in my life and around me that fall into other categories that I'm aware that sometimes people aren't given the benefit of the doubt or they're judged differently than others. So I'm really aware of the fact that it's not always equal. So I try to really think about that in an objective sense. So for me, don't struggle with that. But I understand why that's can be hard. But I think, again, in this COVID environment, you kind of strip all that away and it's look at outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That someone is, oh, this person is deserving because they delivered results, not because they happen to be a good drinking buddy to someone else or they were there for, you said, the outputs that maybe actually aren't all that important in terms of outputs. But, and you referenced the challenges that you've had in being in marginalized groups and minority groups. And so a number of our listeners also fit into that in some way and are always curious about how do you overcome some of that professional adversity that I imagine you've experienced because of different backgrounds. Any stories that stand out of, hey, this was a challenging moment for this thing and here's what I did to either fix it or at least come to terms with it?
Yeah, I mean, overcome is a weird word. I mean, I feel it's a fact of life. And for me, it goes back to maybe something my mom instilled in me. I'm pretty sure her mom instilled in her. It was kind of this idea that, I mean, I remember being very young when she told me this. Hey, you have multiple strikes against you in life. You're a woman. You're Black. I mean, she knew I was Asian. Obviously, she's my mom, but she's the world sees you as Black, right? And because your skin's brown. And you're going to have to work twice as hard to get half as far and paid half as much. So just know that's a part of your life.
Wow.
And it's not feel sorry for me, wish it away, wish that wasn't your life. It's just understand that that's part of your reality. So you have to move and navigate through life understanding that and adjust for that because that is your part of your lived reality. And so I think knowing that, you behave accordingly.
Mm-hmm. And so obviously this is, people are finally, I mean, diversity and inclusion is partially a buzzword, but also rightfully so that we should be talking and doing more around it. From your perspective, again, especially as a leader and having come through this challenge, what can we do to make it so that hopefully that's not the case for the next generation of people to say, hey, just expect to work twice as hard for half as much?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we truly, truly, truly wanted to solve it, I believe we have to treat it we do any other strategic business imperative. So, for example, when we say that we want to win at Walmart, we create a strategy around it. We have action plans. We have measures. We have trackers. We create incentives. We reward people. We discipline them when they don't meet those objectives. But for somehow, and some reason, when it comes to D&I, we're working on a hope and a prayer. And D&I is a strategic objective, just everything else. In fact, there's empirical data to back that up. There's a McKinsey study out there that's been out there. They went and measured this and said, hey, firms with top tier diversity are more likely to outperform firms that aren't financially, right? So in a way, if you're for profit, frankly, or non for profit, it's in your best interest to uphold this. And so it's in your best interest from a business building standpoint, let alone, never mind that it's the right thing to do because it is, right. But say you don't care about that. It's a fiscally responsible thing to do because you're going to have better business outcomes. And so I think if you treated it as a business initiative, a business strategic imperative, you would have strategies, you would have measures, you'd have actions, you would have trackers, you would reward people, you would discipline them, and you treat it the exact same way you would any other strategic imperative. And you wouldn't just be, I hope it gets better. Let's have conversations. Let's have conversations about why. Let's have conversations about hoping to win at Walmart. Then everyone will look at you, you had a third eye or you were a complete idiot, right? And that's how I feel when people say, let's talk about D&I. Because conversations are great, but don't expect to have outcomes.
Yeah, well, I love that our articulation, that comparison, and sometimes just a flip out of exactly what you said. Let's just have conversations about, yeah, winning at Walmart or whatever the strategic. Let's see. Let's have a conversation about sales. Okay, we're done. Hopefully something changes, I think is such a great, clear way to focus on it. And to your point, it's not that it's a, I mean, certainly there's a component of it's the right thing to do. It's a human thing to do, which also, I think fortunately, the younger generations have that more, at least that's what the studies show, right? Is that they're more in line with not just companies that are for profit, but companies that have a strong mission statement that are doing good in the world, et cetera. And that should be a component of business, that it's not just how do I make the most money the fastest way possible. But to your point, there's studies showing that even if your emphasis is on how do I make the most profit, diversity and inclusion, D&I, is an important component and strategy to that. So I love that articulation. And so as we, you know, start to wrap up, one, this has been certainly an incredible conversation to hear your perspective on things. We to do a little bit of a rapid fire round to get to know also the human behind some of these fantastic insights and learnings that you've shared. So ready for a couple of quick rapid fire questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Excellent. So what fact about you surprises people? So for example, random fact about me is I dislike mint ice cream because I've never been eating, you know, ice cream or chocolate and been not thinking, oh, you know what, go great with this toothpaste. All right. So just random fact is that it's just a thing that I don't, any fact that surprises people that about you?
Both my first and middle names are Disney princess names. So my first name's Tiana, my middle name's Jasmine. So.
And is that intentional? Is that where the names came from? Or it just happens to line up?
I'm a hair older than the Disney princesses, so.
Okay. So basically, if there's a Disney princess that comes out as Conley, then you'll know that someone at Disney is just following your life. Fantastic. What's your go-to media escape? Are you reading books, watching TV, watching movies, something else?
I do Twitter since 45 got banned. I like Joanne Reed, and I'm finding more and more time to read books these days, which I thoroughly enjoy.
I love it. Anything, any book that stood out enough that you're, all right, I'm going to give that to a friend because it's just something that they've got to read this.
A book that I love that I read recently is Hood Feminism by Mickey Kendall.
Okay. And what is high level? Because I've never even heard of it. What is very succinct? What is Hood Feminism?
Well, the idea about Hood Feminism is that feminism is generally something that's reserved for suburban white women, but the premise behind her book is that feminism should really be something that's inclusive and really cater to the most marginalized of women because it would uplift all women and frankly beyond women and really solve a lot of the world's problems if you thought about it more inclusively.
Oh, wow. That is fascinating. And last rapid fire question for you is, so you spent a number of years in Cincinnati, now in the Chicago area. What's one thing you miss from Cincinnati for those of us from P&G who have spent our time there?
Bonbonnery Tea Room, hands down.
So good. That was immediate.
It's so good.
Immediate. So for those of you in Cincinnati, you can enjoy that. Well, Tiana, this has been fantastic. We've just got one last question for you as we're looking forward towards the future. Any final piece of advice or challenge that you would give to the next generation of leaders?
I think that your past does not have to define your future. If I think about my heritage, my mom came to America really speaking very little to no English. Her mom from the Philippines had an eighth grade education. And I think I've exceeded beyond what even I could have imagined for myself at this point in my life, and I'm not done. And so I think that don't limit yourself by your past and don't limit yourself by what you can imagine.
Wow, that is a great inspirational way to close. Well, Tiana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show. Like what you've heard, please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the PNG Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former PNGers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment in communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
Now, here's a preview of next week's episode.
In Egypt, I was struggling and losing a lot of money. And on a very hot afternoon outside the factory in the middle of pyramids in the desert, I walked for 30 minutes with John Smale. And that 30 minutes changed my life. I was feeling very low that I'm working so hard, yet nothing seems to work. I said, John, I've lost 23 million. I feel terrible. I don't know. Maybe you guys should fire me. He looked into my eyes and said, Mohan, if we had anybody else, we would have lost $100 million. Remember, your value will only be known after you have left this site and gone on to do other things. So make sure you are laying good foundations for the people who will come after you.
That's it for this week. I've been Andrew Tarvin.
And I'm still Roman Segal. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the PNG Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.